If the estimates are accurate and people who identify as transgender account for about 0.5% of Indiana's population, these Hoosiers, as a demographic segment, certainly receive a disproportionate amount of legislative attention and, some would argue, legislative abuse. Hi, I'm John Schwannis, and on this week's show, we'll examine some of the nearly 20 anti-trans bills introduced this session. Critics refer to such measures as the slate of hate, while supporters say they're motivated by a sincere desire to protect the rights of parents and the health and well-being of children, especially those too young to make life-altering decisions. Indiana lawmakers, from the State House to your house. And joining me to talk about an issue that's making headlines here and across the country are Democratic Senator J.D. Ford of Indianapolis, Democratic Representative Chris Campbell of West Lafayette, Chris Paulson, Chief Executive Officer of Indiana Youth Group, an advocate for young people who identify as LGBTQ+, and conservative political activist Micah Beckwith, pastor of Life Church Assembly of God in Noblesville. Thank you all for being here. As I mentioned at the top of the show, this kind of legislation is just taking off here and across the country. Almost 20 bills here. People who monitor these things, human rights campaigns, say as many as 200, 300 bills pending in various stages of acceptance across the country. What is going on here? Explain to me why this flurry of activity.
Well, you know, it used to be that all politics were at the local level. But now I think politics are moving to the national level. And we are seeing groups like ALEC and Alliance Defending Freedom and other groups across the nation pretty much have these boilerplate bills, and legislatures are just taking, they're not even being creative with these bills, but they're taking them and they're introducing them in other legislatures. And I think it's because, frankly, it's easy for these folks to, other people, and wave around a bill when they go back to their home districts and say that they're taking care of, you know, the LGBTQ community down here at the State House. And quite frankly, what they're doing is they're making it difficult for LGBTQ Hoosiers who are just that. We're Hoosiers trying to live our life, pay our taxes, you know, and just be a good citizen of the state.
And just to be clear, you're not buying the argument that many of your legislative colleagues make, that this is an organic issue. It's they're hearing from constituents who are calling, writing, showing up in their offices with the books that they find objectionable and or pornographic.
I don't buy that.
You don't buy that at all?
I do not buy that, because every single time in committee, on the floor, we have asked for, as the kids say, receipts. And we don't get them. Where is this happening in our state? Tell us, so that way we can address it. But they just say, oh, you know, people are calling and writing, and that might be true, but I don't think that it's at the same level as what they're saying.
Chris Campbell, you were over here agreeing. How much of this, though, is attributable? Here, your district is Indianapolis. Your district is West Lafayette and her environs. Those, if you look at a presidential election map, tend to be a blue. Tippecanoe County is a blue county. Marion County is a blue county. Sort of islands of little pockets of blue. Do you think if you were in a different district you might be hearing, or again, is it just this is all being manufactured elsewhere?
Well, we know that this legislation is coming from specific groups. The language is the same. It's multiple states. It's not a coincidence.
And Chris, I mean, you've watched this. Your organization is one of the oldest, I believe, continuously operating since 1987. So your organization has seen a lot. Why do you think there's been, I mean, it's not as if people just started identifying as transgender in the last year or two. You look at some of the data from Williams Institute at UCLA and others that suggest this has been a pretty constant number in terms of the segment of the population. Why do you think it's such an issue now?
I think because conservatives see it as an easy target. Not everyone knows a trans person. These days, everyone knows a gay or lesbian person, probably has one in their life. So it's easier to target people you don't know. So I think that's why we're seeing it. It's an easy target, and it wins them political points, unfortunately, at the expense of youth and LGBTQ people.
And I've seen some of the national pundits who've said this is serving the purpose that, for instance, the pro-life messaging used to serve in terms of mobilizing a certain constituency or base, that there needs to be some other issue. And if that is essentially off the table, at least temporarily, that it's moving on to something else. And I guess if I want to get the answer to that question, I look at somebody on the other side.
Yes. Well,
explain this to me. Why, we humans have been on the planet, depending on your beliefs, either millions of years or 6,000, as I'm guessing you would yeah. prefer. Why only now is this the drumbeat surrounding the issue?
Well, I think a lot of it came in 2020. I think parents saw what was being taught in the schools, and I think they were appalled at like the misinformation that was being pushed on their children, and said, "Hey, whoa, these aren't the values of my family." Especially in Indiana. Indiana is a red state. We have conservative values on the whole. And we said, enough's enough. And so I think that's where this started in the last couple of years. Now, to push back on this isn't really happening, I'm on the Hamilton County Library Board. I see what is being pushed in the kids section personally. I see this transgender push. And I have parents that have come to me in my congregation and said, this is what my child's learning in school right now. They've shown me the material. They've laid it out for me. We've seen it firsthand. And so we're just saying as parents to say, let us be the ones who decide what is right and wrong to teach when it comes to sexuality. And I don't know why this is such a big issue, because, you know, we'll take like Senate Bill 408. We're basically saying if you're in first, second or third grade, just, you know, keep the sexuality to a minimum. Let's make sure that we're teaching reading, writing and arithmetic. But we're getting a big pushback on that even. So really, this is about, I guess my question is, this is more about where is truth, right? What is true in our culture? Are we going to go down this path of saying we're going to affirm everything a child wants? Or are we going to say, no, this is true and this isn't true, and we have to stand on what we believe to be true as a state?
And there's so much I want to circle back, because yeah. the whole notion of parental rights is a fascinating discussion. If you look at, for instance, Senate Bill 480 versus, yeah. say, House Bill 1608, yeah, which seemed yeah. to be...
Pastor Beckwith was referencing House yeah. Bill 1608.
Right. Well, let me... just, again, for those who aren't following this, and I'm not saying all of these are moving toward enactment. We already had the governor sign one bill, essentially, you know, that would bar individuals, medical professionals from providing gender-affirming care, whether it's medical. I mean, the concern, I guess, initially was surgical, but we heard testimony that there is no such surgery being performed on minors anyway in the state of Indiana, that it's mm-hmm. it's
correct.
Puberty blockers, it's other sorts of pharmaceutical treatments. But again, that's gone. But then we also look at not paying for inmates who want to have those sorts of procedures. It's opening the floodgates, perhaps, or let me not use a loaded phrase, opening the door to more litigation, civil litigation, targeting individuals who seem to run afoul of parents' sensibilities. What we saw last year, the notion of competition at the mm-hmm. high school and grade school level, which the governor had vetoed, but then subsequently was overridden. There are a lot of manifestations here, and the one that certainly that Pastor Beckwith mentioned was this notion of harmful materials, and maybe that's what you see as your service on the yeah. library board. Of all of these things, is there one that sees that you see as particularly insidious or
I find it all.
You're not
gross.
Selective.
I'm not happy about all of it, and the reason for it is because, as I mentioned before, it's all manufactured, right? Mm-hmm. And they're really good at taking an issue such as, you know, the harmful materials to children. But in that particular bill, the word inappropriate is used. If they were truly trying to get at the heart of the issue, they would just call it for what it is and say pornography, right? But they don't do that. They say inappropriate. And your definition of inappropriate and my definition of inappropriate, it could be potentially different. In the 1608 bill that Pastor Beckwith was mentioning, there is no definition of human sexuality. And so if there is a kid with two moms or two dads, and, you know, the teacher says, okay, kids, let's come to the carpet and let's have a conversation about what you did this weekend. And one kid says, oh, my dad took me to the apple orchard. The teacher then could not really respond unless there was a question posed. And I think it's insulting to an entire profession to think and believe that we have teachers in our classrooms that are trying to push inappropriate material to children. I just find that insulting.
That bill, for the shorthand that's been assigned to it, is Indiana's version of Don't Say Gay, because it again, K through third grade, you don't address those in the curriculum, and then teachers would have an obligation to notify parents if there's a request to have a new name or pronoun and so forth.
May I add one more thing?
Yeah.
So, and I'll let my other panelists chime in. But
you'll even let all the panelists chime in.
I'm passionate about this because I think it's just going to harm so many people in our state. But it, to me, you know, my Republican colleagues say this is about parental rights, but I think it's about selective parental rights. In the 1608 bill, you know, the school has to notify the parents about, you know, if the kid wants to change their name or pronouns, right? But then you go to Senate Bill 480, and it takes the parental decisions out of the mix.
Even if parents approve, it's
yeah, and even on on 1608, even if your family has come together and they want to affirm a name change or a pronoun change, and you send in the information, according to the latest version of the bill, a teacher could, under religious objections, object to that. So even if the parents have made that decision, they can't because of the religious objection.
All right, I'm going to break the order here and go right. Respond to that. How do you explain, reconcile those two?
Well, I think we're saying as a state, we don't want to do something to a child that's going to have long-term consequences when it comes to their physiological makeup. And I think 480 is saying, wait until you're an adult to make these life-altering decisions.
Even if the pharmaceutical treatments, apparently, according to the medical community, are reversible, right?
That's not even agreed on by many in the medical industry. I know pharmacists who have said the opposite. They've said we're seeing now that these are actually unreversible, non-reversible when it comes to long-term studies that are actually being shown.
And but so, what facility in the state of Indiana is doing these surgeries? You're talking about life-altering decisions.
No, but I'm saying these are issues that are going to be coming down the pike, and we're getting ahead of them in Indiana.
We have institutions that are saying that these surgeries aren't happening in our state.
But the pharmacists, the pharmaceuticals that we are.
You're talking about the puberty blockers.
The puberty blockers, and those have long-term side effects.
You do understand that puberty blockers are being issued to precocious teens who have acne and other things. So what this
which would be acceptable under the which is the ACLU suit. You're not targeting the procedure. You're targeting how it's used.
Correct.
And these medical pharmaceuticals have been used for decades. They've been used safely for decades. We've got a lot of misinformation out there, a lot of scared parents, a lot of people that are confused about what's going on, and they're getting a lot of mixed messages. That's not helpful for the child, that's not helpful for the parents. What that child is going through, what the parent is going through, those are two different things, and those need to be separate. And the outside public, your opinions and your feelings are also playing into that, and that is separate. And all of these are playing together and causing a lot of confusion, a lot of misinformation, and leading to, you know, for harmful reactions and interactions for the child. So,
Chris, Paulson, I want to also add, and feel free to elaborate on that point as well. But I also want to the point that kids might not be old enough to make a decision whether or not it's alterable or not. I looked at the data I alluded to earlier from the Williams Institute, which was fascinating. I mean, it breaks it down by state and by ages. And generally, for instance, in Indiana, it's basically 0.5% if you look at a 13-up population.
Correct.
But if you look, and this is a national phenomenon, if you look at the 13 to 17 age group, it's almost 100% higher across the board.
Yeah.
So my question is this: if it is, how do you explain that? Is this because it drops, these are unchanging numbers largely for decades, at least as far back. Doesn't that suggest that kids may have interest in a transition at that age group, but then somehow the enthusiasm dissipates? I mean, can that be inferred from those numbers, or is that just a gross misinterpretation?
I mean, every kid grows into who they are, and as adults, we're still growing into who we are.
It seems like the numbers would go through the system. I mean, that you'd have that rather than it dropping from essentially one plus more than a 1%, but it seems to always drop. Yeah. I don't know what I just.
But we have to think about, at one point, did you know your gender identity? Most people know that young, you know, 3 or 4. I'm a boy, I'm a girl. You understand that innately. So I think it's not unusual that those numbers drop, because that's the period that we understand who we are. And these decisions, you know, I keep hearing kids are making these decisions. Kids are not making these decisions. Doctors and parents are making these decisions along with the kids. So it's not like they're unguided. There's 27 different medical societies that agree that this is life-saving care. Indiana right now,
Academy of Pediatrics, okay. Right, American Medical Association.
Absolutely. Indiana right now ranks second in the nation in youth who die by suicide. These bills are going to drive that higher.
Is that persuasive? I mean, you're again a man of who preaches mercy and love. How about this notion? You look at the statistics and the suicide ideation or maybe even attempts are so much higher among individuals who identify as trans.
So that's the argument that's commonly used. If you don't affirm them, they're going to commit suicide. Well, Sweden, one of the nations that has really only done the only long-term study out there that's been years and years of looking at what does this gender-affirming care actually do 10, 15, 20 years down the road. And they are now seeing that suicide rates haven't dropped. They're seeing that, and they're actually pulling back on their gender-affirming care because they realize we thought this was going to actually save people from the spirit of suicide, when really it's the same. And so I think that's a scare tactic. I think people are saying if you don't affirm this child, and parents are being told by doctors, if you don't affirm them, you're going to have a dead child on your hand. And I reject that fully. I say, no, we can affirm truth in their life, and we can do it in a loving way. We're not trying to eradicate anybody. We're not trying to come down and move people out of society and say, hey, we want to affirm you, but we want to also speak truth to you. And I guess my question would be to my panelists is, where's the line? At some point, is there ever going to be a truth that we say to a third grader or a fourth grader or a teenager, this is wrong, like we shouldn't be doing this? Oh, I feel it. Like, what about the anorexic? Do we just affirm the anorexic and say, hey, your brain tells you you're fat, so here's some diet pills for you? No, we say, hey, your brain tells you something that's not true. We love you enough to tell you the truth and to actually move you in down a path that actually is going to be helpful to you in the long run.
First game, how about that?
As a parent, you know, we don't know how our children are feeling. They are expressing something to us. They are trying to tell us something. As parents, we may reject those feelings. We may have our own feelings, and those are our feelings. And it's up to us to separate those feelings. I know we're getting a lot, again, so much misinformation. Medical facts and data that has not been accepted by the medical societies of the world, and we're quoting these facts as facts. It's really, you know, the parent really needs to, and our society needs to accept that our feelings may not reflect what that child is feeling, and it's up to us to help them figure out who they are. They're going to figure it out whether you reject it or not. You can try to pray it out. You can try to convince them something. You could try to abuse it out of them. All you're going to do is hurt them, make them feel shame, make them feel guilt about how they're feeling. But ultimately, their feelings are their feelings.
We see that, you know, we keep hearing this is a fallacy, and it's not. Unfortunately, at Indiana Youth Group, we see these kids every day who are not affirmed by their parents, who have mental health issues. Not mental health issues because they're LGBTQ, but mental health issues because they're not being affirmed by their parents, not allowed to get the medical treatment that they deserve.
And I would just say to Pastor Beckwith's comments, the facts don't lie. If you read the Indiana Youth Institute's book on, you know, kids, they had a presentation in the chamber. It shows the statistics that bears out that LGBTQ youth are not doing well. Actually, all youth in our state are not doing well, but particularly LGBTQ youth. And I think Pastor Beckwith is actually making an argument for universal health care when he always cites Sweden, and because some of those countries...
Wow, do we have a social...
Some of those countries have
universal health care.
A study from Sweden.
But the other thing I will say is that, you know, and I hear you when you say we want to affirm them in their truth, but the reality is that...
No, in the truth, not their truth.
The reality is that, you know, even for myself, when I was trying to come out, you know, and trying to tell my parents, I couldn't do it. And I knew that my mom and dad loved me. I knew that they told me to shoot for the moon, land on the stars. I knew I had a great support network, but I just couldn't do it, right? And that's what these young teens, young adults are going through, is that it's hard. And there is, that's why there's a facility here in Indianapolis, because some of these kids do come out, and they unfortunately have to be, you know, the parents kick them out, and they have to, you know, find another place to live. And that's why we have a facility here in Indianapolis to help with
and
that.
And that sort of that parental, that's such a crux of this, is that we've already discussed. And let me just try to get some clarity here on this notion of parental rights. For the sake of discussion, if you had parents who were non-believers and insisted on raising their child as atheists, yep, but the child wanted to go to church, whose side are you on? Are the parents?
The parents, absolutely. The parents, absolutely.
If they're devil worshippers, yep, you're still on the side of the parents.
God has placed that child in that home, all right? And parental rights has to be key always. Now, I would come alongside
so
of those parents.
You agree that parent that affirms their child, then they should have that parental right to affirm their child.
I 100% agree with that.
Okay.
Do you also agree that God made that particular child in his or her image?
100%. Yep, okay. We're all made in the image of God.
So if that parent wants to get medical care for their child, then you are in support of
them.
Are
we going to go down the path of saying, okay, because mom and dad, I have a 6-year-old who wants to be a pirate. So am I going to, what if I believe that he really was a pirate?
John,
I'm going
to,
happens,
don't have
no,
good, solid
that's
arguments.
Not true. That's not true at all. If I was going to, you know, affirm my child in that and take him into a medical procedure to have his leg cut off and his eye gouged out, like we would say, nobody does that, but I'm saying we would say that's ridiculous.
Nobody's going to do that.
It's ridiculous. That's why nobody does it.
If you're a non-believer or a devil worshiper,
I would come alongside of those parents and say, listen, what you're doing is wrong.
But God has placed that child. Intervene.
Yeah, the state should not intervene. The state should not intervene.
You just made the argument for Senate Bill 480. The state should not intervene into a
parental
decision.
When it comes to medical care that could have long-term effects, I think we should pump the brakes, hold for a second, wait until that child is 18.
Not listen to
professionals. That's all we're saying. We're just saying wait until that child is 18.
Why do you get to make that decision? Why do we as a General Assembly get to make that decision?
78% of voters actually agree with me on this issue.
They don't.
Yes, they do.
No, they
don't. The Trafalgar Group came out with a study in 2022, and they said 78% of voters, and it was 96% of voters actually agree with, Republicans agree with this, 80% of independents.
There's some Pew data, though, from 2022.
53% of Democrats agree with that.
The danger of going to citing polls, it's all how it's the questions.
I'm just saying, there's a lot of,
we can elicit it.
There's a lot of data out there.
Right.
And you're constantly contradicting yourself.
No, I'm not. How am I contradicting myself?
Let me. You talked about the danger of where do you draw the line. And you just said, wait till you're 18. But there are states where that was sort of phase one. And I don't know, 6-7 states, we've seen a move toward banning these procedures, gender affirming procedures at all ages. Mm-hmm. Are you worried that this is just, I hate to use the cliche, the slippery slope, but is that what worries you?
Yeah, it is, because we see those bills in other states. We know they will move here next. It's like Senator Ford said, it's a package, and it hits, you know, Florida, Texas, Tennessee, and then it hits us.
Would you support that, or are you going to stick with what you said about 18?
No, I think once you're 18, I'm a limited government guy. And I think once you turn 18, you now have all of the freedoms that are afforded to you by our Constitution, which means if you want to go out and do something that I disagree with, if it's going to, I will tell you what I believe, I'm going to tell you what I think, but you have the right to go out as an 18-year-old, as an adult, and make those decisions that affect you, and I'm not going to ask the government to step in. And,
so if that bill's introduced next year, you've got somebody to testify.
Come on down.
I know you said you don't like any of this, it's all bad, but is there anything here that you see any middle ground? What about using tax dollars to pay for gender reassignment of inmates? I mean, can you at least give on that point? I mean, is that
sure? I mean, I can understand that, but the problem is again, it's not happening. We talked to the Department of Corrections. They are literally monitoring 100 people in the Department of Corrections who fit, you know, their intake form, right?
Well, why not? If that's not happening, why you're flipping the argument back? If it's not happening, go ahead and forbid money being used for. I mean, wouldn't that?
Sure, we could do that, and then the ACLU will sue, and it will cost more money to pay the lawsuit than to actually do the surgery.
Well, then we'll do another topic discussion on that.
Well, and I would say that, you know, a lot of these bills are on a witch hunt, and there are no witches. And let's put the brakes on getting the lighter out.
Do you know what else I think is interesting?
This will be the final word, because I told you time goes fast.
Yes, so two things. One, none of the Republicans came to this panel to defend these bills.
Thankfully, I'm talking about my colleagues in the General Assembly, and we did invite sponsors.
Yeah,
and
thank you to Pastor Beckwith for coming and providing the other side. But the other thing I will say is, you know, Governor Holcomb, when he was asked about Senate Bill 40, he said it's clear as mud.
That was the day before he signed it.
And then he signed it. And so that's what we have currently.
All right. I'll tell you what, great discussion. You all bring up a lot of great points, and the passion is palpable, and I applaud and appreciate the discussions, because that's the only way we're ever going to make any progress probably on any of these issues. Thank you very much. Again, my guests have been Democratic Senator J.D. Ford of Indianapolis, Democratic Representative Chris Campbell of West Lafayette, Chris Paulson, Chief Executive Officer of Indiana Youth Group, and Micah Beckwith, pastor at Life Church Assembly of God in Noblesville. And time now for our weekly conversation with Indiana lawmakers analyst Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight, part of Hanna News Service. Well, Ed, I mean, we could talk about the issue that we discussed in the roundtable, but there's so many bills, some signed, some still pending. We won't get in the weeds there. But there are a lot of other big issues I know that are brewing that we'd be remiss if we didn't talk
things
about.
Things other than culture wars.
Yeah, other than culture
there's
wars.
Tax wars.
Believe it or not.
Tax wars.
What are you watching this week?
It's interesting to see what's happening with property tax reform, property tax relief. The House Republicans, the House majority, wants to impose some kind of tax relief, property tax relief, understanding that property tax bills in a number of counties have gone up by 10%, 20%, essentially due to increases in assessed values. The actual sales of homes are affecting the assessed values. And they want to give taxpayers some relief in the form of changing those constitutional caps. Giving,
which is now 1% for primary residents, for instance.
The 1-2-3 caps, right. So they're trying to offer property tax payers some relief, residential property taxpayers. The Senate Republicans, the Senate Majority Caucus, prefers to pay down debt, wants to make sure that we do something about the pension obligations that are still out there. And they essentially slapped down their colleagues in the House this week by saying, no, we want to do something other than property tax relief. We'll give tax relief in a different form, but we're not going to necessarily do it the way that the House wants to do it. And on top of that, we also saw a week ago the differences between the House and the Senate and the rank and file and legislative leadership on some of the hospital tax issues. You know, the legislative leadership has been big on hospital profits. Well, in the Department of Local Government Finance bill, there's now a provision, thanks to the Senate, that essentially all health care properties, real properties, will be allowed property tax relief, won't be subject to property taxes. There's going to be a big fight on that.
Because that you had what was shaping up to be disastrous for, say, the Hospital Association. Now it comes, it could be their best session ever.
They have some relief.
All right. Proof that everything eventually turns back to money and away from culture, I suppose. Ed, thank you as always for your insight.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
The American dream is to own a home with a picket fence. Is that dream still achievable with a shortage of affordable housing, construction costs, and higher utility bills? We'll bring it all home on the next Indiana Lawmakers. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwannis, and on behalf of analyst Ed Feigenbaum, WFYI Public Media, and Indiana's other public broadcasting stations, I thank you for joining us, and I invite you to visit WFYI.org for more State House news. Until next week, take care.